When you're about to go on a cross-country course, you go at it 100 miles an hour. But every foot beat, you could break a leg, you could die, that could be the end of everybody, dead fast. You haven't got time to think. You have to do your preparation beforehand. You have to know your kit is sorted, that you are prepared. You have to know yourself inside and out. You need to know what frightens you, how you deal with fear, how you keep calm, how you transfer that through to the animal that you're riding. And you can apply that in any sense, but you have to know who you are and that your kit is sorted before you start the journey, so that you can transfer that confidence to your team. And those values and that instinct that drives you all is really clear, so that you don't need to debate it. It's a given.
Hello and welcome to the Building Better Leaders podcast, brought to you by Scaffold Coaching. I'm Rachel Sullivan.
And I'm John Tattersall.
Hello and welcome to episode 27 of the Building Better Leaders podcast. And I have to say, I think this has been my favourite conversation so far. So yeah, I think I'm going to go that brave, John, and say episode 27 is my favourite one so far. But before we get on to our wonderful guest and our conversation today, how are you? We're in February, we're still in lockdown. I know you struggled a bit at the end of last year. How are you going, John?
I'm good. I've got to the point where I can see the light at the end of the tunnel, and I'm just, not every day is brilliant, but yeah, I think I'm getting there. What about yourself?
Yeah, good. I have my good days and my bad days. I love January, to be honest. I ran every day in January, inspired by you doing your running challenge, and having something to focus on really helped me. I'm also still off the booze. I'm on day 40 of not drinking. And I am feeling a lot better for it, a lot clearer headed, sleeping better, I'm feeling better. But yeah, it's had a bit like the, you know, Groundhog Day, everyday feeling is coming a little bit. But my dad's had his vaccination. So I think that was quite nice for us last week. And he said it did...
Do you feel better for him?
Yes, I do. And it also seemed very, very well organised, which I think everybody needed to see. Mm. And I think we needed to feel a bit of confidence in the government again. So that has helped a little bit. So yeah, so that's how we're doing. It feels good to be on episode 27, doesn't it? We seem, you know, a quarter of the way to 100.
Yeah, this is a great guest coming up. Yes. Going to tell lots of stories. Lots of analogies, but we've been mixing the podcast up a little bit, haven't we? And we've had some cracking guests over the last few episodes.
So for those of you that have been with us a while, you notice that some of the podcasts are just with John and I on, and they've got the green covers, and then there's the white covers that we have guests on. Now we're getting quite a few guests. We've decided to run it how we would run a coaching engagement. So we're going to have guests on for 3 episodes, and then we're just going to do our coaching and leadership essentials podcast and coaching approach podcast once a month. So we'll kind of use the subject matter experts with our guests, and then we'll try and bring all that knowledge together into our fictional character setting at the end of that month, to kind of share how those learnings can be brought into like a leadership reality for many of you.
Yeah, so we started at the end of last year, didn't we, when we recorded the podcast with Celine.
Yeah.
And that was about emotional intelligence. And if you've not heard that podcast, that is absolutely wonderful. And she finishes talking about introspection. And I think... there's definitely a connection between that and the one that we've got coming up for you today. But in between that, we've talked to Kevin Arutia about entrepreneurship. And that is a fabulous podcast if you're interested in people who have just chosen to run with different companies in different sectors, built them all up themselves. And he's like constantly, isn't he, moving towards something else. But what he does he does very well. And it's not like he takes his eye off that the ball. He continues to deliver those services and those products really well. But yeah, he's a real ball of energy, isn't he, Kevin?
Yeah, very, very insight driven. And at just 31, for how he's been able to spot new opportunities in the market, has just been phenomenal. So yeah, I feel like our run of three guests this time have been really good. So on to introspection and our guests for today. Philip has had quite a considerable career. Just to give you a taste of some of the stuff that he's going to talk about today, Philip started, well, we ask him the big question, don't we, John? When does your career start?
Yeah.
And he has a wonderful tale around how he bought a horse as a child, and how this led him to have a fabulous career in the polo circuit and British eventing.
British eventing, yeah.
And it took him to the Middle East. He at one point led a team of 50,000 people, which we can't quite get our heads around, meeting and hosting events with British royal family and international royalty and prime ministers, to today been a very senior leader in an educational setting. It is an incredible journey. For us, I think what Philip does really well is he balances that introspection with self-awareness, with self-learning, with curiosity, with so much humility and fantastic storytelling. I mean, this podcast is about an hour long. I could have listened to this guy for about 3 hours. I think there's just so much more we could ask him. But yeah, anything you want to add before we jump in, John?
No, I think other than to say, I can only reiterate what you said. We talked to him afterwards and said, we'll have to have you back, because there are so many more stories for him to tell. And I really do like a lot of the analogies that he uses, because they tend to stick in your mind, I think. You build up a picture of that for yourself. And I think it's a really good way of remembering stuff. So hope you really enjoy this podcast that we're doing. If you are enjoying what we're doing, please do leave us a rating or even a review. We really do appreciate it.
Welcome to the Building Better Leaders podcast. Today, we are joined by Philip Grant, who heads up the 16 to 19 education at Blackpool and File College, which is the third largest general college in the country with over 16,000 students. So, Philip, welcome to the podcast. Would you just like to tell our listeners a little bit about yourself and the role that you do today, please?
Hello, Rachel, and hello, John, and hello, everybody that's listening. Yes, so my name is Philip Grant. I'm the head of 16 to 19 education at Blackpool and the Fylde College. Blackpool and the Fylde College is a general further education college. It covers every curriculum area, from apprenticeships to further education to higher education. It's award. It does its own degree awarding body. It awards its own degrees. And my role is very much working with the senior team to make sure that the strategic direction of the 16 to 19 group is on track, responds to national agendas, particularly at this time of crisis, and ensures that the delivery of the education is the highest it can be, so that students get a really good quality education.
Yeah. So are you doing any teaching yourself, or are you on the side purely?
No, I haven't taught for a few years, and that's the part that I really miss, actually. I went in when I first started my career. I started as an instructor, as a technician, actually. And then, you know, long story short, ended up leading organisations. So, yeah, real turnaround.
So, Philip, we've known one another for about 10 years or more now. 11 years. So I'm wondering, when you started your career, did you ever sort of envisage ending up where you are? Because you've had quite a varied sort of experience of leadership throughout your career. And I'm just really, really interested in whether you could share those experiences as they've changed over the years since you first started.
Absolutely. I think, when do you start your career, really? That's a question, isn't it?
Question.
Because that's a question I ask myself constantly. When was it I first said, this is my career? And I speak to lots of young people, and I have done throughout my working life, and ask them the same question. And I think for me, it probably started when I was fairly little, a young boy, actually. Grew up in Manchester, and in a large family. And I think probably at that point, I started to think about what it was that really interested me. Now, my father was a policeman. Mum was a nursery nurse. And I was always fascinated by leadership. But I didn't know it was called leadership then. And what used to interest me, John, was people that influenced huge numbers of people, either teachers, head teachers, in my world then, as a student, to people I saw on the telly or heard about, prime ministers, the Queen, people in history, good and bad people in history. And you think, how the goodness can one person have such influence, good and bad? And I think that's probably where my career started, because there was something there that made me interested in that.
So you were aware of this thing called leadership, but it wasn't leadership in your mind. You were seeing it in what you would sort of view as high profile figures.
Yeah, I was fascinated. I was fascinated by probably that power, control, influence, how people respond positively and negatively. And how did you learn about that? Where did you go to train to do that? I was fascinated as a young boy with Winston Churchill. And this, as you know, John, will bring you on to probably the first part of my career. I was one of these people that my family thought I was completely crackers, and probably still think I'm crackers. I lived in the middle of Manchester, and from a very early age, I wanted to learn how to ride a horse. Now, nobody in my family had ever done that before, and I'm not really sure why I wanted to do it. But Winston Churchill fascinated me, because a lot of people maybe don't realise he actually was a very famous and very gifted and talented horseman. And a lot of the very famous quotes that Winston Churchill will come out with are based in that lore, that folklore of the horseman, which is fascinating. And I've always loved to listen to those and how he dealt with certain things. One of the most famous sayings he ever said was in the 1930s, it was advice to mothers of being a parent, of bringing up young boys. And he said, if you want to know how to bring up your young boy to make them a gentleman, teach them how to ride a horse. And it's a very famous saying. And I think that probably got me into that mindset of, that might be the root of learning about leadership and becoming how to deal with this thing. I think probably that was the spark of it, perhaps. That's maybe where it started.
So what happened then?
Oh, goodness me, how long have you got, Rachel? That's a long story. I'll try and be quick as I can. Very, very long story short, I went to a local riding school. I learned how to ride. I paid my way by doing, a cycle 20 miles a weekend. I did all the work for less than a month. And then I actually went out and I bought a horse from a meat market and hadn't told my parents about it. And I paid £300. £300. Yeah.
At home with this horse then. What do I do?
No, so I didn't tell anybody. I went to a meat market. I'd heard all these cheap horses were going for sale. Yeah. And of course, they were going for slaughter. So I went to this meat market and I paid my paper round money and bought this horse for 300 quid and then brought it to a friend who had a small farm in Saddleworth, where I lived, where by then I lived, and I rented a corner of this field and didn't tell anybody for about 2 weeks that I'd bought this horse. Anyway, I told my parents when I planned it for when they were on holiday, and they'd gone away. They went on a holiday to the south of England in a caravan, and I phoned them up and told them that, oh, by the way, you know. So, and then after that, very quickly found that I had a real passion for learning through mistakes. One of the sayings that you have with when you ride horses is, if you fall off, when you do, you regularly fall off and you get injured, that what you have to do is very quickly, don't really think about the pain of hitting the ground, but get back on again and start getting on again before shock kicks in. And actually, I've applied that an awful lot in my life, that when you're hit by a blow or a disaster or something hard, don't dwell on it, just get up and get on with it. And actually, by the time you've started to recover, you've mentally moved on anyway. And that's always stood me in good stead. So after that, I very quickly, that horse was bought from beneath me by a huntsman, paid me a lot of money for it, thankfully. So I made a big profit on that horse from £300. I think I sold him for about £3,500. And I bought my next horse, which was an unbroken thoroughbred. Again, nobody taught me, I just got on with it, learned by my mistakes. And within a 5-year period, I actually did my first international 3-day event under the British flag banner. By then, I'd done a bit of training. I was working a little bit. I was paying for my passion. And I was learning the hard way. I went to my first international competition in the north of Scotland with members of the Olympic team. They all turned up with sponsors. I had to borrow a trailer. I slept in my friend's tent. 3 of my friends came to help me. It was one of those real rags to riches scenarios, although I never made any money. You know, it was a really phenomenal story.
And how old were you by this point?
I started riding when I was about 14. I bought my first horse when I was 14 and a half. And then I was probably in my late teens right. at this point. So, I was driving for sure. So, very quickly after that, I then was pulled into teaching. I went to train as an instructor. And that's probably where my life really started to change, because I started to see then how all these analogies I'd heard from Winston Churchill and a chap called Xenophon, who was a Greek general from 500 BC, and all these great, great historical people that have built our world. We're not aware of them. I saw them coming into play, and I saw in the equine world, it's a bit of a bizarre place because it's actually based very much in military training and movements. So every single thing you can think of that you'll see somebody do with a horse is actually a killing movement. It's how to kill your opponent, everything. So if you think, Rachel, if you ever see the Olympics and you see people on a horse doing dressage where they do those dancing movements around a square area, well, dressage comes from the French word to dress, which means to prepare for battle. And those movements are all killing movements. So when they do a passage, when the horse moves across the area to the side, that's a really good way of taking out four opponents on your left-hand side whilst you're chopping the heads off the dudes on the right-hand side. So they're all fighting movements. Mm. So the actual routine of training horses is very much based in the old military and the terminology and the discipline and the control. And actually, probably the hardest thing to understand about the relationship between a horse and a rider is you have to influence an animal that naturally wants to run away, but you have to influence it to run into things that would frighten you and it confidently without speaking the same language or being able to communicate. So that's a real trick. It's a real art, and it's and there's an awful lot. And I think it's fascinating that even probably in the last few years, I've seen a real increase in the popularity of people who are doing counselling with horses and leadership skills with horses. Well, I could write you 3 books on it, you know, because I've lived it.
Horses as well, isn't there?
Well, exactly. So I completely identify with that. I get that. You know, I'm a byproduct of it for the last 30-odd years.
Can I jump in then, what you said? Because I rode a lot when I was in my teens, nothing like what you did, but I went to university in America and you could do a university course in horse riding as an extra. Yeah. And it's so interesting what you said, but it is due to leadership, is that you had to give the space enough, you had to give the horse enough space that it wasn't near enough for other horses that you wouldn't have control of it, because as soon as it got near the rest of the pack of horses, it would do what they did, not what you wanted it to do.
Yeah.
And I think about that in leadership. How often do you just get pulled along with the group? And that's what horses do, don't they? They get pulled along with the group.
Well, the flip to type, don't they? They go back to their instincts. And sometimes in leadership, that's a good thing. Yeah. But from my early career, working with horses, it taught me a lot about myself. Taught me a lot about communication, taught me a lot about courage, fear, pain, failure, all of those things by the bucket load, 10 times a day. You know, you just go through it. It's a really hard way to learn, but, you know, I thoroughly enjoyed it. So from those early days, you know, once I started teaching and was qualified, my career just took off. You know, I found my place working with people in education. I worked in colleges in Scotland and in the north of England and the south of England, and became very quickly known as a specialist in that land-based equestrian area. I was asked to go abroad. I worked for Sheikh Mohammed. That's a very long and interesting story, which I won't bore you with. But I ended up writing the standards for all the instructors and trainers for the British Horse Society with a small group of people. And then out of that, I was asked to go and work abroad for Sheikh Mohammed and run a centre of 50,000 people in the Middle East. And the idea in the Middle East is they wanted an education system where all boys were taught to ride and hunt and shoot, because that's what you have to do in the Quran to be a man. So I could understand that mindset to graduate from a boy to being a man. Those are the skills that you need to have. So, you know, I did that for a while. Then I came back into education and went into senior leadership.
When you were teaching there then, Philip,
yeah.
How much of what were you teaching was really just your experience? And did you have to mix that with some sort of kind of academic work, or were you really drawing a lot from your own life?
I think if I go back, maybe a couple of years just before that, when I'd done that trajectory of started off falling off, to riding, to being a very competent trainer, training people, running, you know, large departments and sectors within that specialism. I was adopted by a group of people, a really hardcore group of people who were phenomenal. And they were the British eventing crowd. And I was asked to run large competitions within my colleges and curriculum areas. I hadn't had a clue what to do with that. And That taught me. I worked with two ex-retired major generals from the army, and they all gravitated to that kind of world because it was about complex battles that you were going into, and they applied military, the theatre of war philosophy to it. And it worked brilliantly because actually I spent 350, 350 days planning one day or 2 days in the year, a couple of days sleeping, and then the one day, I gifted it, and it started and it was no longer under my control. And on that day, it was all about, and you've seen them, John, I know you've been to see them, the complex, multifaceted, fast-moving situations with tens of hundreds of thousands of people are all moving in dangerous places at the same time. And it all just works like clockwork. And that's when I first realized that leadership was about planning and culture and how you influence people. And that's when the penny started to really drop then. So I was in my probably mid-30s by the time. I was a slow learner, from being a teenager. It took me 20 years before I finally started to get it, what it was all about.
To learn by
I am going to interject just quickly to take us slightly off topic from leadership and promise this will be quick. But I can just hear our listeners kind of going, the glitz and the glam of this life, it'd just be amiss of me to not ask you, come on, that Jilly Cooper, that royalty, the scandal, the money, give us your highs and lows without, or that those scandalous moments without naming any names of just things that you saw or did. 2 minutes, just a bit of...
The highs, I would say, sitting on a balcony, having organised an international polo match with a number of prime ministers and members of the royal family who were my guests, with a crowd of 30,000 people. And I was commentating it because it was my party. That was a real highlight, real highlight. Sponsored by Bentley and Ferrari. I had a Ferrari for a few days, which I couldn't fit into. They're too damn small. But anyway, so that was a real highlight. A low light, I would say. I don't think I've ever experienced a really low moment.
Real hardship, I guess.
Every day in that world is tough because. The whole act of having to work 40 hours a day to feed and finance a fleet of horses and buy them and and equipment and without sponsorship, not having enough to live on, living in a caravan for a number of years in a muddy field, watching people go on holiday. It's a hard life. You have to really commit. If you're not committed, forget it. You're in the wrong world. You have to believe and love it.
That is your rags to riches story though, isn't it? From sleeping in a caravan to sat next to royalty, I suppose.
What have you drawn from that experience then, Philip, in how do you use that now in the roles that you've had since then? Can you equate those situations?
Oh yeah, completely, completely, John. I am the product of my life, aren't I? And I think probably, when you're trying to run a business, and there's more money going out than that's coming in, the weather's horrendous. There's people knocking on your door. There's so much you're motivated to achieve, but you can't. There's things stopping you. There's barriers coming at you from every single angle. It's really hard. And I think that's as a business owner in my earlier career, a professional rider, or in a college or in a school environment. It's the same thing, isn't it? It's just a different product. It's the same philosophy. It's hard. And I think what I learned the hard way was I know who I am. I know what I am. And I know what my values are. I know what my instincts are. But more importantly, I know what my unconscious bias is. And I know that every minute of every day, I get pulled between those three things. And I make sure I get pulled between those three things. Every decision I make, I always think, well, that's my instinct. I don't want to fail. I want to win. Of course, that's me, you know. But then my values are, well, I want to be fair. I want to be compassionate. I want to be truthful. And my unconscious bias is pushing me in a different way. And I have to find that right, you know, that middle ground, which is hard. But I like the fact that it's hard, because if it wasn't hard, I wouldn't be doing it properly, if that makes sense.
Absolutely. I'm interested with, so we'll come back to the rest of your story now, but when you talked about that, I wonder if, did some of that come about during that time when you were in the Middle East? Because talk us through how you end up in the Middle East and how was that different, and how did maybe that kind of help with that understanding who you are and your biases and your values and things like
that? I was responsible for about 50,000, the training of 50,000 people within the organisation that I worked for. And that meant I had a large team of people that we would put on training packages for different languages all over the known world, in different areas of the leisure industry or the industry that this company was engaged in. My particular specialism was about running a yacht club, multi-billion pound yacht club and polo club, which of course I'd never done before, but you know, I applied my own logic to it of dealing with people. And there were people around me who were specialists that I managed. But none of them spoke English as their first language. There was only, I think in the organisation, there was only three of us who were native English speakers. And the first thing, it opened my mind to the world and where we as the UK fit into the world and how we have influenced the development of the world over the last few hundred years, but where we are today. It also made me realise the importance of communication. And actually, most communication is nonverbal. Absolutely taught me that from day one, that it's about modeling. Communication is all about the essence of you and the way you model and the way that you live and the way that you conduct and the way that you influence people by what you do. And if you do not say and do in the same page, you've lost it. You might as well pack your bags up and go home. You've got to be able to be authentic. You have to be, what you say is what you do. And that's where it comes back to the first point, Rachel, about knowing who you are. Because if you don't know who you are, you can't, in my experience, you can't be a successful leader, because it will pull you to bits, because you'll try and be something you're not. So it's about being authentic and then being able to apply that in whatever situation that you're in.
Yeah,
so communication, definitely.
Is that a gift, being able to differentiate between what somebody says and how somebody actually, the body language that they use? Is that something that you think is a gift, or can anybody really learn that?
I think we're all, the one thing that being in a place where people speak different languages, they work at different rates, they're under incredible pressure. You come, you're challenged to your core humanity. And I think I'll give you an example, John. I had a finance meeting one day, and the finance director said to me, "Okay, we've just shipped from the north of Scotland sand, because in Dubai, if you want leisure sand, you buy it from Fife in the north of Scotland. You don't have access to it in the Middle East because it's too gritty. So the kind of sand we wanted was silica sand, top quality silica sand from Fife. So we shipped a shipload, and I mean a shipload, in." And my finance director said to me, "Right, we've got 180 articulated loads arriving. How do you want them unloading?" And I thought, what kind of question is this? How do you unload sand with a dirty, great big digger, surely? And they said to me, "No, we've got a choice. You can either do it the mechanical or the manual way." I said, "Well, you're going to have to educate me. I have no idea what you're talking about." And they said, "Well, we can either use a fleet of diggers, which will cost us the hire, the fuel, the man, because it'll have to be skilled men to drive a digger. They're quite expensive." I said, "Okay. And there's another option?" And they said, "Yeah, what you can do is you can get a chain gang." I said, "I didn't know what a chain gang was." He said, "Well, we'll go and get the chain gang master in, and he'll tell you." So this chap came in and he said to me, "What you can do is you can hire 40 men on a 12-hour rotational shift. And they work 6 days a week. They do 12, the hotbed, to do 40 men with a shovel and a wheelbarrow. They'll do 12 hours and then they go to bed and the other men get up and then they come and do 40 hours. And they do that rotationally for 6 days a week for about 4 weeks, and it'll shift it all." And I said, "Well, I need to go and see where these men live before I make that decision." And I went into the desert to what looked like a chicken hut, tin roof, squalid, horrible, horrible place, to be met by hundreds upon hundreds of men from Indonesia, Afghanistan, Pakistan, that were brought over to do exactly that, manual work. And if you've ever been to Dubai at the time, it was full of people like that were cheap labour. So I had a real challenge with this because I couldn't make that decision. So I said, "Well, I want to talk about it." So we spoke about it with a few people. And in the end, my instincts were telling me, we're going with a digger. We're going with a couple of men, a digger, and we're going to get it done. But actually, we went with the men because we employed the chain gang, because they were there, they needed work. Their money was being sent home to keep their families alive in certain villages. Without them, they would have been in a dire place. But what we did do is we put in three meals a day, morning, noon, and night, for each shift. And the kitchens fed them as well, properly. And we made sure that they had appropriate PPE to work and rest breaks that they didn't have on any other work. So that decision was purely driven from my humanity, that I wanted to help, but I also wanted to get a win-win, that I could live with myself, that I'd supported what was almost the nearest thing to slavery I think you can get in the modern world. You know, it was a horrendous situation.
Sorry to interrupt, I'm listening to you and I'm thinking this must have been about 10, 15 years ago?
12. About 13.
And I'm thinking, I'd love to say I'd have asked the same questions as you, but I mean, I wouldn't have done 15 years ago because I don't think I'd have had the perspective taken because I'd have been in my 20s. But I'm just thinking other leaders listening to this thinking, you knew to ask about your supply chain and to ask that question to go and see where they lived. And I think a lot of leaders are only waking up and asking those questions and going to see those things today. And that's why we're in the situation with what we're doing to the planet and society now. Yeah. So I'm just interested, you know, that humanity, that humility, I don't know if I'm jumping ahead here, but making this is that connection with the horse, that it's a living, breathing thing and that needing to be close.
I think there's probably, I think
where did it come from?
I think there's an element of, I don't know if it is, Rachel. I think inherently in this country, we're all law-abiding citizens. We're animal lovers. We're known for it. We're kind to each other. You know, we're brought up by the rule of law and being civil. And I think it's just tuning into that. So I think the only element of that is, you know, in my early career, I knew that I had to check everything, a bit like a parachutist, because I would die. It was very likely in the next 10 minutes what I was about to do, I could die. And actually, I didn't want that on anybody else's head but me. And I had to check my kit, and I had to check it to the point I was happy with it. And I've always approached things like that. I check things to destruction before I unroll it. And I use that philosophy when I'm in a boardroom, that I have to test it to destruction because that's my job before we unroll something that affects other people, particularly students, because it's their livelihood, it's their life that we're affecting. So that's possibly where that comes from. I've never really analysed it like that before.
It's such an incredible leadership trait. And I do think, you know, I worked out in India for a little bit, and I think being an expat, or you know, being somebody English who's put into that situation, you are naturally inquisitive, aren't you? And you know, I certainly used to pay over and above because if I knew it was going to their children, and you know, you wanted to know what was happening to that child, and you do ask different questions. It's the outsider, you put yourself as the outsider looking in, didn't you? So I do think that's a really beneficial thing. But let's get back to your story. I'm so fascinated. How do you go from being in that situation where you're working in the desert to teach to now having such influence over 16 to 19 year olds' lives? So talk us through the next step of your leadership journey. I'm fascinated.
It's funny, you know, because now I'm old enough and long enough in the tooth that I understand where my career started, and I don't look at my career as the different jobs or the roles that I've had. My career is the skills that I've developed as a leader since I was a young boy doing a paper round and cycling to a riding school, as lots of people will have done. It's those skills that probably I would class as my career. So, and what I've learned over the years is actually you can apply them in any setting, in any world. So when I came back to the UK, I went back into education, but I was asked to go on into senior leadership, and I was put outside of the curriculum area. So I wasn't allowed. The principal I worked for challenged me, wanted me to become better than I was, and gave me finance to manage, and gave me marketing and admissions and premises and buildings to manage. So to move away from the curriculum and become a more rounded leader. And it was really tough because it was putting me outside of my comfort zone, because I didn't intuitively understand that. So I just relied on my humanity and my experiences of communication and trying to get a win-win. And I realized that I needed people that knew what they were doing, because I certainly didn't, you know. So I needed people that had a clue about buildings. And then I realized, actually, my role is about empowering these people. And actually, I need to remove barriers so they can do what they can do really, really well, because that's my role. I think I struck it lucky. I was quite successful at that. And then, long story short, I was asked to go into secondary education and lead organisations that were failing from a secondary perspective as a head teacher, as a principal. And I've done that with great success. So, and again, it was just the same process, Rachel. It's just clear, transparent, authentic, values-driven leadership, where you realise that your role is to empower other people to be good at what they do, because they're the specialists. And I think, and that, you know, that stood me in good stead, really.
So how long were you a principal for?
About 6 years.
And then the move to where you are now?
Yeah, that's right.
Incredible. So talk about that passion from the passion for horses. Has that now transferred to passion for young people, or are you still very much in the equestrian world as well today?
No, I'm a bit of an oddity that there was always two things I wanted to do in my life. Education actually never came into it. There was two things I wanted to experience when I was younger. One of them was I wanted to learn to ride, and that took me on a journey. And I can safely say that I've achieved more than I ever expected, and I'm very grateful for it. It's made me the person that I am. But because I can't do it to the standard that I want to do it, I won't do it at all. So I learned how to play international polo at the age of 40, and I was taught by members of the British team. And I can't play, for anybody that's listening, I can't play low goal polo. I can only play high goal polo. So I have a handicap of 4, which...
Good.
Well, it puts me in a place where I'd have to be a millionaire to afford the kit to do it in this country. I just can't afford it. So, you know, so I left that in the Middle East. Done it. Thank you very much. Achieved that. Moved on. Another thing I wanted to learn was how to sail. So I started to sail when I came back. You won't be surprised when I tell you that the first thing I did is I came home with a boat that I'd bought, and I told my wife that I'd bought this boat. It cost me about 1,500 quid. And she said, well, that's lovely, but you don't know how to sail. I said, no, neither do you, but we're going to learn, aren't we? So we taught ourselves how to sail. And went and did some, after we crashed it a few times, we went and actually invested in some proper training with the Yacht Association. And that's what we do as a family. You know, we learn how to sail, and we do that as a pastime. So, yeah.
So there are quite a lot of crossovers, aren't there, between the equine and the sailing. So sport analogies. How much do they figure in the leadership sort of skills that you bring to the work that you do now?
Oh, that's a loaded question, John. I think you know that. I've always, going back to this communication thing, I've always tried to describe how I feel, or where I'm going, or where I want to go, and what that journey will look like to people that I teach, classes that I teach or I've taught, or individuals, or to groups of staff or groups of people in an organisation. Try to paint a picture in the mind of this is what it looks like, this is where we're going, this is what it looks like. And I do draw a lot on analogies based in my past experiences that help people understand that. And it's quite funny, because I try not to use the ones that people predict that I would use. So I'm known for my sailing analogies or my battle analogies, you know. I try and keep well away from horse analogies, because a lot of people just don't get them, you know, because they are quite unique. But yeah, I use analogies quite a lot, I would say.
Do you think there's a book in there for you?
Oh, there could be a couple, actually.
Analogies.
And just to kind of, you know, where you are today and the leadership challenges that you're facing today in the education sector, and you talked a little bit about influence, and you know, you've not just got influence over these young people's lives, you know, it's their whole family lives, really, I suppose. You can't live with a teenager and not feel the energy of a teenager across the whole family. So just talk us through how you juggle that and what your leadership approach is, and you know, any useful kind of tidbits in that, what you do today.
I think there's probably two parts to that for me, Rachel. I think we go back to right at the start where I said, I think the most important thing for me is knowing who I am. And I mean that at a granular level. And I don't think a lot of people get the opportunity or are maybe brave enough to go there, because that's quite hard, actually, going to that place. And I would say that people that I see in my everyday life, people that I work with, people that I work for, I can split them into two categories of people, me included. And I would say that people are either selfless or they're selfish. And they're motivated, depending on the situation, there could be a bit of both. It depends on that situation. So leading schools, being involved in leadership at colleges, is the most privileged position you could ever be in. I absolutely loved being a leader of secondary schools, because it is whatever people tell you about teaching, it's wrong. It's the best profession you could ever get into. It's phenomenal. If you are a selfless person and a values-driven person, you will gain more from it than you would ever in any other sector. It is phenomenal, but it is challenging and it is very difficult, because sometimes political agendas, politicians, the decision making is far removed from where it needs to be to have a big impact on young people. And I think at the moment, people in education are particularly, just like people in the NHS, are doing a phenomenal, phenomenal job against the odds, but also against the leadership odds of support that they should be getting from other elements of the institution, which they're not. So I think what it teaches you is that you're in a very privileged position. We're also in a position of real influence. And it comes down to your humanity again, of how you interpret your actions or the information that you get and how you then apply it. And I think that comes down to influencing young people. As a leader in education, you're there for young people, to guide them, to support them, to help families. I always approach decisions that I make to the point that I know a family would be sat around a dinner table, if they have a dinner table, or they'll be at home and they'll be talking about that decision. Well, the college is doing this, the school has said this, the teachers are doing that. How does it impact on me, particularly at the moment? And I think you have to really understand that with the decisions that you make. So it goes back to that, right to the root cause of what your decisions are. You know, I know that it influences people every day of their lives. So you have to really know how you think about your unconscious bias, your values, and your instincts, to how that impacts on other people, without a doubt.
It's a very good description of how you think it through, Philip. I'm wondering that, just on a day-to-day basis, there's lots of decisions to be made, and you're in a very fluid environment, and all these decisions you make will affect different people who are at different stages of development. So you might make a decision that involves an 11-year-old, and then they go home and they talk to their parents, and then that decision impacts on them. And when you were talking earlier on, you talked about checking your kit and making sure that you had everything in place. When you have to make decisions very quickly, that must be extremely challenging. I just wonder how you go about that for the benefit of our listeners.
Let me go back 30 years then. So when you're about to go on a cross-country course, you're going at 100 miles an hour. At every footbeat, you could break a leg, you could die, that could be the end of everybody, dead fast. You haven't got time to think. You have to do your preparation beforehand. You have to know your kit is sorted, that you are prepared. You have to know yourself inside and out. You need to know what frightens you, how you deal with fear, how you keep calm, how you transfer that through to the animal that you're riding. And you can apply that in any sense, but you have to know who you are and that your kit is sorted before you start the journey, so that you can transfer that confidence to your team. And those values and that instinct that drives you all is really clear, so that you don't need to debate it. It's a given that in an educational context, the student is the priority. So that is what drives your decision making. So you don't have to procrastinate about it. You know, that is the value that we're driven by as an organisation, as by individual people, and therefore that's why we make these decisions, or we all get behind it. And that's how you deal with working at pace. If you don't know yourself, and you have to then chew it over and think, how is this going to... You take too long. And then and there may be some examples in the world at the moment, John, that we can see that decisions are taking too damn long because people are procrastinating instead of just getting on with it. So I think that's how I would approach it.
How do you reconcile that between... You spoke earlier about the two types that you would put people into two groups in teaching. Those
selfish, selfless.
And sometimes you could flip depending on the situation. But what you spoke about just then, I can see resonating with those that are more selfless and the student comes first. How do you reconcile that student needing to come first with the group that are selfish in teaching?
Rachel, when I was saying about selfish and selfless, I was meaning people in general.
Oh, right. Okay. Yeah. I understand. No. Yeah. Not just in the classroom environment.
People in the world are motivated. We're all motivated by particular things. And you can see it in the world when normal, sensible, law-abiding citizens, here there's a pandemic, we're all going to go out and buy toilet rolls in case we run out. And they become selfish, don't they? They don't think of the greater good. They think about themselves. But they may not normally be like that. It's circumstances that sometimes drive them. Now, I would say that generally, the majority of people that are in the service industries, the public sector, education, the NHS, would absolutely be selfless, wouldn't they?
Yeah, and if you check, I suppose this is why people occasionally go into teaching thinking one thing and then they choose to leave, and it's maybe at that point in their life they are more selfish, or they need to be more selfish. Yeah. That makes absolute sense. John, you were going to ask a question?
Yeah, I was thinking that, I mean, I've seen you in action, Philip, in terms of like walking the floor in the school. Mm-hmm. And knowing all the pupils' names, and actually knowing where they are in their development on their journey. And so, you know, what you've talked about today is a lot of it's been about communication and the way that you communicate with people. I just wonder how important that is in terms of getting pupils on your side so that they are in a space where they will listen to you and is then just not being, you know, teenagers and don't talk to me sort of thing.
I don't think you can make the distinction between children and adults. I think it's just people in general, John.
Yeah.
I think that Let's look at that question then. So we're all individuals and we all identify with people who share traits that we can identify with. That's our unconscious bias. So people who are sensible, kind, hardworking, people that evaluate challenges are people that I like, I follow, because I would like to think I have some of those traits. People that are selfish, make decisions just for themselves at the expense of the rest of the country, depending on what country you're leading, are not people I would follow, you know. So I think we all buy into people that we can assimilate with, that we can identify with. But how do we know that we can identify with these people as leaders if they keep the mouth closed and they don't share information and they don't model that behavior? We don't know, do we? So I think the first thing I would say is you have to be authentic. You have to be transparent. You have to know who you are and don't be frightened of sharing it. And share your cognitive processes with people. Oh, God, I don't understand this. I have no idea what this is. Tell me, you're the specialist. Help me understand it. You know, it's showing people that you don't understand. That's what they're for. And people, students, children, adults, buy into that. But I think before you get to that point, you have to get to the point of, I'm on this earth to live a happy, fulfilled, kind life that I can learn by. And I hope other people are the same. And if I'm talking to a student, I would say to them, my entire function is to know you and what you want to achieve and to help you achieve that. How can I help you? And the first thing I'm going to tell you is, I hate maths. I don't like that teacher. Or I love this. Can we do more of this in the curriculum? Or why does that not happen anymore? So you get a dialogue going and then you listen, you share a common theme, and then you deliver and then you build confidence. And then that student who was maybe very hard to reach will go, I like him. He's honest. I want to be like him or follow his model. I'll follow his lead. Parents are no different. Parents, you listen to them, you share a common bond, and then you move things forward. And likewise, in teams of people in the organization, we all assimilate with people that we understand. And, you know, and I think it's building that relationship. So it's communication and building relationships, definitely.
I think that what you've touched on there is something that a lot of us don't really, as we get older, don't really think about. But leadership in the corporate world has had to change from this kind of command and control to the style of more influence. But it's exactly the same for children in school. You know, I remember being at school, which, you know, probably it's like 20 years, 30 years since I was at school, but it was one of very much command and control. You had to listen. You were doing this. And you never listen when somebody tells you to listen. You pretend to listen and then you go, what did they just say? I can imagine that at Blackpool and File College, the power structure is very far from command and control. But can you talk us through how power is used and how influence is used and when are the two perhaps considered and how do you come to a consensus around how to use power and influence as a leadership team for our future leaders, essentially?
Okay. Can I give you an analogy for that one?
Love an analogy. Go for it.
All right. Okay. Bear with me while I think it up. So when I was a young boy and I first started to learn about movement, moving things forward, when I was learning how to ride, I was always told the stick or the carrot analogy, and it's a horse analogy. You either use the stick to make it go or use the carrot to make it follow. So if I think about that now in the world that I work and I live, I would say that over my career, let me think of an analogy. Right, if I was a gardener, when I When I first started my career as a gardener, I was given a job to tend a vegetable plot. And that vegetable plot, I would make sure the soil was dug over, I had the right carrots in the right row, and the sprouts in the right row, and I would make sure they were weeded and everything was delivered on time, and when I was told, they would be boxed up and sent to market. Okay, so that's my gardening approach. But when I became pretty good at that, I was given a dozen gardens to manage, and I had to make sure all these dozens of gardens had to have the carrots in the right row, it was on time, it was done in a particular regimental way. But then, because I was pretty good at that, I was given a whole market garden to manage and make money from and make it viable. So that's when I started to use my leadership skills, and I realized I had to then look about finance, organization, structure, timing, marketplace, output, people management, getting all the other gardeners to do things at the right time, etc. But then when I became a senior leader, I had to change again. And I realized that actually, when I was a manager, senior manager, I was about making things work in the right order, that A went to B and B went to C, and it was very mechanical. But when I became a leader, or my leadership skills came to the fore, I realized that actually, I had to become a little bit like the sun, and a little bit like the wind, and a little bit like the rain. And my entire role was to create the environment for the market garden to grow and bloom and blossom. And I had to have an understanding of how carrots grew and the temperature, but actually my role was to make sure the temperature was correct, the environment was the climate for growth, and that there was a shield around it to protect it from the harmful rays of the sun, and everything that got in was just pure goodness that could help it move forward. So that people and all the other gardeners, of which I was once, could actually thrive. And I think, to me, that's what command, control, carrot, stick, that's culture to me. But you don't build that as an individual person. You build that as a team of people, because it's about your values. It's about what drives you. It's about why you're there. It's about all of those elements. So I know that's a long-winded answer, but I think, from a leadership perspective, for me, it's about culture. It's about you. Your purpose is to take away barriers and to enable other people to grow as a leader, I would say.
Brilliant.
A really useful analogy. And that's what a lot of good leaders do, is they create, it's the environment and the conditions to allow other people to work in. That brings us very nicely, I think, Philip, around to we ask each one of our guests to provide three leadership essentials, three things that are important to them. And I'm sure that you've got way more than three. But could you give us the three that you really, really stand out for you?
I think, you know, reflecting on the conversation that we've had, and I feel like I've had more of a therapy session. some of these places I've never even...
You feel therapized.
It's always lovely to talk about your own journey. I think, you know, going off tangent, I don't think we do it enough. When you reflect on how far you've come, you kind of almost don't realise, do you?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I'm sure if we had longer, we could get into even more detail. Oh. Let's not go there. I think probably for me, if I was giving myself advice as a 14-year-old that starting out on this leadership career that can apply in different jobs and different sectors, and understanding that leadership is something you can learn, actually. I've learned the hard way. I continue to learn. I think the first thing I would say is take a long, hard look in the mirror and get to know yourself first. I would spend time, invest time in evaluating your values, understand what your values are, how you apply them, and how they're affected in different situations. Understand about unconscious bias, and also learn to identify when your instincts are kicking in. Don't always ignore them, but don't always react to them either. So I think it's about having a balanced check and balance section of yourself, understanding who you are first, and then put yourself in that position, understanding that you will be challenged every second or every day if you do it properly. It's not easy. I think that's the first thing. Mm-hmm. I think the second thing would be, now you've put yourself into that position, or you've been employed to go into that position, or you've been asked to lead that organizer, or whatever situation you're in, that's because of those qualities that you are, that you stand for. So don't hide behind them. Put them out in the world, front and center, and say, this is who I am. This is how I respond to things. Share that with people. I regularly, you know, anybody I've worked with will be able to write my values on a wall and say that I live by them. Everybody would. And I would say, celebrate them, be transparent, and don't be frightened of sharing your cognitive processes. So when you're working difficult things out, articulate it. Say to people, I don't understand this. I need your help. How do we get through this as a team? Let's test it to destruction. Let's evaluate it. Let's come out with a common theme that we're all happy with, that we can take forward. And I think it's about modeling those processes. It's so people can identify with you as a human being, and somebody that has, you know, sleepless nights, concerns, you haven't got all the answers, but you can work it out together. I think that's the second thing. And then I think the third thing is, if you do find yourself in a position, which I have, when you've been in a very influential position, where it feels as if you have an awful lot of power and influence, and when you're at that place, people treat you with great respect, with great dignity, and, you know, it can be quite addictive. But my advice would be, don't believe your own hype. You're not that good. It's not because of your brilliance that people are treating you like that. They're only treating your position like that. It's the seat that you're in. When you're no longer there, you're just not a normal person again. You haven't changed. And I think the greatest challenge for people would be to be the same person in the chair and not in the chair. There should be no change in the person that you are. That's if you're being truly transparent and authentic. So those would be my three things. Does that help?
You have given us, and I've certainly learned a lot, and I've known you for a long time, and you've certainly given our listeners a lot to think about there, Philip. They are quality leadership essentials. There's a lot in them. We'll put them in the show notes for people to peruse at their leisure. I'd just like to say thank you very much, Philip. Really, really enjoyed chatting to you today.
Fascinating stuff. Yeah, absolutely. I could listen to you all day. I didn't really know what to expect going into this conversation. I've never met you before, hence why I asked some of the questions. But that third leadership essential, that's gold, that one. That really is. I don't think many people get to that. To that stage, it's very difficult, very uncomfortable, but that's authentic leadership at its core, I guess. So a lot for me to reflect on, actually. I think listening to this, love to chat some more. Could chat all day, couldn't we, John? But we know you're on a tight schedule. I'm sure there's a lot of people, a lot of young people that need your leadership skills. So thank you so much for giving up your time. We really, really appreciate it.
Well, do you know, I've thoroughly enjoyed it. I feel as if I generally have had a therapy session that I've invested a little while in just being able to talk about things I'd forgotten, to be honest, and maybe packed away on a dusty shelf. But yeah, can I just leave you with this one thought?
Please.
You know, one of the greatest things about working with people, animals, or particularly young people, is they just always, if you get it right, they always trump you. They always do better than you, and that's what you want them to do. And I remember once having a conversation with a group of really tough lads who were, you know, not from having a great time, from an underprivileged background, and really in a difficult place. And they were building a good relationship. And they said to me, how are you going to change this place then? You know, what are you going to do about this? This is the worst school in the country. How are you going to change it? And I said, well, we'll look at the leadership change management process, which is an entire different story. And I said, what I want you to think about, boys, is I want to think about a vat of milk. And the school has been a vat of milk. And you're the new yeast that's going to turn it into a yogurt. And it's going to change that culture of the organization. And I thought that was quite a clever analogy. And as quick as a flash, one of these boys said, no, sir, you're the yeast, we're the fruit, we give it the flavour. And I thought, fantastic.
Brilliant. He's going far, whoever he is, yeah.
Well, that's the point. Everybody has those leadership essential skills, don't they? You just need to be brought out, I think.
Thank you so much for listening to the Building Better Leaders podcast. We hope you've got a lot out of this. If you'd like to read up a bit more on any of the content that you've heard in today's podcast, be sure to check out our website, scaffoldcoaching.com.